Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop. The Ivy stocks a wide selection of books covering Baltimore and the Chesapeake Bay region, many by local authors. Located at 6080 Falls Road, more information can be found at theivybookshop.com.
Hello from the Baltimore Sun. I'm Dan Rodericks, Sun columnist and host of Roughly Speaking. This is episode 333 for Tuesday, December 12, 2017. 8 Democrats are campaigning for the nomination of their party to challenge incumbent Republican Larry Hogan. I've had conversations with 5 of those gubernatorial candidates by now: Jim Shea, Ben Jealous, Alec Ross, Kevin Kamenetz, Rashern Baker. With 3 more to go, Maya Rocky Moore Cummings, Krish Vignarajah, and today's guest, State Senator Richard Madaleno. An invitation has been extended to Governor Larry Hogan. So far, all we've received is a thanks for the invitation. Rich Madaleno is a veteran of the Maryland General Assembly, having been first elected in 2002. He is a former legislative staffer known as one of the General Assembly's top budget experts. After serving a term in the House of Delegates, he moved to the Senate in 2007. He has risen to vice chairman of the Budget and Taxation Committee, and as the Sun's Michael Dresser pointed out in a story about Madaleno, he is consistently one of the small group of senators in the room when spending decisions are made. When he announced his candidacy in July, Rich Madaleno told Dresser that he would be the first Montgomery Countyan, the first Italian-American, and the first openly gay person to be elected governor of Maryland. Rich Madaleno, welcome to Roughly Speaking. It's nice to have you here in Baltimore.
It's wonderful to be here, Dan.
Why are you running for governor?
As Vice President Biden said the other day in Virginia, governors are now more important than ever before. That with the craziness that we see coming out of the Trump administration and the Republican Congress, to me, governors, states are where we need to stand up and protect our traditions, our civil society, and so governors are important. The governor of Maryland is very important. The governor of Maryland, believe it or not, is the most powerful gubernatorial office in the country. Our state constitution reserves more powers for our governor than any other state constitution. So our governor has a large role over setting the agenda for our state. And then quite frankly, in Maryland, I feel like we face a bunch of challenges moving forward: economic, environmental, education. And if we don't have a governor who's pushing for some of the big answers to those challenges, pushing for trying to figure out where we're going to be in 20, 50 years, as opposed to just getting me through the next election, we're not going to face those challenges. And been around for a while in a variety of capacities around the state government, around the legislature, and I feel like I'm uniquely qualified now to help our state, its people, figure out how we meet those challenges and how we put ourselves on a path to success in the 21st century.
We'll come back to that and hear what you have in mind in terms of an agenda if you were elected governor. Mm-hmm. But let's go to some biography. Let's do some background on Rich Madaleno. You were born in the 1960s. How old are you?
I'm 52.
And where did you...
Born in 1965.
65. Where did you grow up?
Interesting story. My parents got married very young. Like many people around the Northeast, they eloped in Elkton. they were living, they're both from Atlantic City.
The thing about Elkton was, Elkton, Maryland, was that you didn't have to wait.
Right.
You could get a license and get married the same day.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay.
So.
Celebrities used to do this. Hollywood figures.
Yes.
Right?
Well, my mom was 19. My dad was 22. They told their parents they were going out for a picnic and drove to Elkton and got married. And the story they told me is they went home and my mother took off her ring and they lived separately for several months before they got up the nerve to tell my to tell their parents that they were married.
They were from New Jersey?
They were from Atlantic City. Yep. So
what brought them to Maryland?
They bounced around looking for jobs, and eventually my father wound up with a job in Columbia. In the building where Clyde's is now, when Columbia was just those 2 office buildings. There wasn't even a mall. My parents decided to move down here, or my father got the job.
What did your father
do? He was working for a construction company. They wound up moving to Silver Spring.
So you grew up in Montgomery County.
Yep. I grew up in Silver Spring.
Where'd you go to school?
I did a series. Do you really want to know the schools? I went to Burnt Mills Elementary, Stonegate Elementary, then White Oak Junior High School. And then for high school,
I went. So all public schools.
Well, and then for high school, I went to Georgetown Prep, which is in Rockville. And then I went to Syracuse University for undergraduate. I have an incredibly useful degree in Soviet studies, although maybe it's coming back into value. And then a master's in public administration, also from Syracuse. I was just fascinated by the Soviet Union, had a chance during my senior year of high school to go on a trip to Moscow and Leningrad. And so my plan was to get the degree in Soviet studies and work for the CIA or the NSA. And then as I wound up moving through my undergraduate career, I realized that I was a gay person. And at that point, you could not get security clearance for being gay. Some friends who were applying for jobs at the CIA, they would come back and say, oh, you know, you have a lie detector test. And one of the questions they ask you is whether or not you have had sexual relations with a person of the same gender. And that would disqualify you from security clearance. So I was like, okay, well, I guess I'm not going that route. So I took the Foreign Service exam. And I don't know if you've ever talked to someone who's taken the Foreign Service exam. And now, this is the mid-80s. I'm sure it's changed tremendously. But it had two parts to it. It had a lengthy part that was all about international relations, history, culture. And then it had an English language piece. And I passed the main piece and failed the English language piece. It was the hardest English test I have ever taken. And
must have been pretty embarrassing for you.
Well, it was one of those multiple choice questions where it was a sentence and you had to rewrite the sentence. And
here
were like four different options.
Yeah. You had a tough time with that.
I think I'm pretty good with English, but it was grammar and those parts. So I thought, well, one of the things that came through in taking the test was, you know, clearly they asked a lot of questions about management. And I thought to myself, well, to work in the Foreign Service, if you're abroad in an embassy, not only are you doing the diplomatic work, you're actually supervising people. There is the management component to the Foreign Service. So a master's in public administration seemed like a nice professional complement to the liberal arts degree. So I wound up staying in Syracuse, but by then I slowly got more and more engaged in politics. I'm sure this will come as a shock to you and to anyone listening. I was president of the student government as an undergraduate. And so I got more and more involved in domestic politics. And as I was finishing my master's degree, I wound up applying for a job with what is now called the Department of Legislative Services, the staff agency to the Maryland General Assembly. Mm-hmm. Believe it or not, the placement officer at Syracuse said, here's a job in Annapolis. And can you think of a more beautiful place to work than Annapolis? And
nice.
It was a budget analyst job. And what I find humorous is I had tried to stay away from every budget analyst job because I could think of nothing worse than being a budget analyst. But I loved it. I mean, actually, the budget and doing that work is absolutely fascinating. It's what drives everything. You can pass whatever laws you want, but if there's not money behind it, they're just words on a page. I wound up staying with the General Assembly for 6 years. I was a budget analyst for 2 years, and then I wound up staffing the Appropriations Committee. And I got very fortunate that Pete Rawlings.
I was going to say, Howard Pete Rawlings.
Howard
Pete. Because he was chairman of House Appropriations, and he was a master of the budget.
Right. So I learned a lot about Baltimore City and the Baltimore area from great legislators, and some of whom went on to be very good friends and mentors. And, you know, I've had the honor now to be colleagues with many of them, and only 1 year with Pete before he sadly passed away.
Yeah. Did any of them whisper to you, you know, Rich, you ought to think about running for office yourself? Where'd that idea come from?
That idea, I think, came from the first time my mother put me in front of our polling place when I was 9 years old. So
you did have that ambition?
Or the idea was
in your head?
Oh, the idea was in my head. And I, believe it or not, it's in my office in Annapolis, I have a newspaper ad from 1933 for one of my great-grandfathers in his successful run for the Board of Freeholders, which is like the county council in New Jersey. He was the mayor of his small town, and then he was running for the county job.
So there's some family history there.
Yes. On my mother's side, both of her grandfathers were local elected officials. They were both mayors of their towns who went on to the Board of Freeholders. So there is that fascinating connection.
Were they all Democrats?
They were all Republicans. It's South Jersey.
That
is a Republican.
Okay. What about your parents?
Area. My parents were both raised Republicans. My mother is a feminist. My mother is pro-choice. I think the Republican Party that she grew up with just totally moved away, and she moved over to the Democratic side much earlier. My father, always to his credit, I always say, you know, he was always a small government person. Little government meant leave me alone, leave my business alone, leave my private life alone. And I think for both of them, you can see that they feel the Republican Party that they grew up with in New Jersey is not the Republican Party that you see either here in Maryland or nationwide. They loved Connie Morella. Like, Connie Morella was their type of
Connie Morella was a Republican from Montgomery County who served in Congress in Maryland for several years and was a moderate Republican.
Yeah.
Okay, but you're a Democrat. Why? And what makes you a Democrat? What makes a Democrat a Democrat?
It can be best summed up as what one of my constituents once said to me. We talked about my high school and going to Georgetown Prep. Georgetown Prep is a Jesuit school. They spent a lot of time talking about your responsibility to the community, your responsibility to your fellow man, being the good Christian man for others, really embracing the social justice mission of the church. And that really got me engaged in those issues. And part of it, well, long before the public schools went with a community service requirement for graduation, we had a community service graduation requirement. And I was assigned to work at a soup kitchen in downtown D.C. called So Others Might Eat Some. And just driving down there every Sunday and serving breakfast and seeing what was happening in the city, that for a kid from the suburbs that you were not exposed to going down, and just my student activism just moved me to the Democratic side. And then certainly coming to terms with being a gay person, there is a big difference between the two parties. And certainly for a long time, I mean, I think it's even more so now, but the Democrats were more embracing of gay people, certainly in Maryland, fighting for the anti-discrimination law. And so it was just where I felt I fit in.
And then the decision to run for office, this was what, 2002, something like that?
Yep. And I think what makes a Democrat is a commitment to transformation. You know, in some ways, they're the two parties, and they switch back and forth over our history. There's always one party of transformation and one party of restoration. And I think right now, the Democratic Party, certainly in Maryland, is the one that embraces the concept of transformation and being open to the future. So in 2002, you know, speaking of Connie Morella, my state senator, a guy by the name of Chris Van Hollen, at the time, decided to run for Congress against Representative Morella. So one of the delegates ran for the Senate, and she said to me, you know, Rich, I think you'd be great at this. You seem to want to do this. Why don't you do it now? It's like, well, I haven't been involved in politics. I haven't, you know, I'm not a party person. And
she's like, you worked in government.
I worked in government. Right. I had eventually gone from the state government to the county government. And I was working, I spent 7 years working for the county government when Doug Duncan was county executive, part of their intergovernmental relations team. So she said, you should consider running. You'd be great at it. And, you know, doesn't matter if you've been involved with the party or not. Usually people get involved and win in Montgomery County are not people who have kind of moved up through the party. I went to my parents, and my father said, look, I've heard you talk about this for years. He didn't quite use this clean language. He was a little more colorful. It was, you know, now is your chance. I want you to do it now or stop talking about it,
right?
Because you're never going to have a better chance. So I ran in 2002. I'd always made a promise to myself that I wouldn't run unless I knew I could do it as an openly gay person. I didn't want to suffer. I'd seen people in Annapolis who were in the closet, and I didn't want to go through that. I'd seen people be talked about behind their backs for being in the closet. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't want to do this. I don't want to face that. In 2002, I'd met my husband, and we were ready to try it out. And so I became the first person to run and win as an openly gay person.
How long have you been married? As long as we've had the law? As long as you've been able to?
Yeah. We got married on October 20th, 2001. So that's when we had our ceremony at our church in Bethesda with our family and our friends. That is our anniversary day. That's the day we got married. We got paperwork much later.
Yeah,
and
right.
We don't
in the last few years.
Right. It was in August of 2013. We don't celebrate our paperwork anniversary.
Right.
We celebrate October 20th as the date that we had our ceremony like everybody else. And that, as we went through the debate on marriage, I would always talk about it. I'm married. We've had the ceremony. We've made this commitment. It's the government just catching up to what already is.
Right. It's amazing still for me to reflect on how fast all that changed.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, from the time we really were talking a lot about same-sex marriage to civil unions and let's go this way and a couple of court decisions here and there to when it finally happened at the Supreme Court. In terms of American history, it's really kind of an eye blink. But there was a lot of background, though.
Barney Frank, the former congressman, openly gay congressman from Massachusetts, he always talks about something that has become known as the Frank Rule, that at any point in time, if you were to look back 5 years, you'd be astonished that in 5 years we could have come as far as we have, because you would never have 5 years earlier had said, this is where we would be in 5 years. It's been remarkable, and that's what I try to tell people. When I first got into the House of Delegates, I was playing constant defense to stop a constitutional amendment from occurring, knowing that if one ever got put before the voters, it would probably pass easily.
You mean to ban it?
To ban it, right. Like so many states, and remember 2004, many states across the country wound up enacting constitutional amendments to clarify the definition of marriage as only being between one man and one woman. And we had a provision in our law that said that. So we played defense. I convinced Mike Bush to change the rules in the House to make it harder for a constitutional amendment to pop up, doing all of those little maneuvers to make sure we would never lose so that we could keep building the momentum. So that's why sometimes when people stand up and say, I was part of the fight on marriage equality, and it's like, that's great that you were there in 2012, but it was a decade in the making, and a lot of those years were lean years. I remember when I first got elected, to go back to your point about how quickly things changed, I had a civil unions bill drafted because that was cutting edge then.
Yeah,
like Vermont had done civil unions, and I remember several of my Democratic colleagues begging me not to put it in because it was just too controversial. They didn't want to face it. And those were people who only a few short years later would wind up having their names on marriage, the freedom to marry for same-sex couples. It was a remarkable transformation.
So you have two children.
Yep.
A son and a daughter.
Yep.
And what do they think about you running for governor?
So 14-year-old daughter, we were doing an interview about the running for governor, and she gets asked by the interviewer, what do you think about your dad running for governor? And she said, I think it's great. He loves to talk to people, about politics. And now he's got lots of other people to talk to other than me. So she's thrilled and excited about it because she just started high school and she's like, great, he's out of my hair. He's doing something different. 10-year-old son, he loves politics. He loves to go to events with me, loves traveling around the state, being engaged. He loved the crab feast in Chrisfield this past year. So he's excited. He's far more excited about moving to Annapolis than she is. He's all for moving to Annapolis, and he's convinced himself my parents can homeschool him while he's in the mansion. It's very funny.
So Larry Hogan is the Republican governor, and he'll probably be the Republican candidate We don't know who the Democratic candidate is going to be. You're one of the candidates.
Mm-hmm.
So if you were to get the nomination, how would you challenge Larry Hogan? His polls are, you know, pretty good. A lot of people would love to have poll ratings like he's had. He's mm-hmm. a popular guy,
mm-hmm.
Ending up his first term here. What do you say to Marylanders about changing?
I think you explained to people that, you know, I'm not running against Larry Hogan's first term. I'm running against Larry Hogan's second term. And that second term is going to be loaded with gridlock. If Marylanders want to see what a second Larry Hogan term is going to look like, all they have to do is look at Chris Christie's second term in New Jersey. You know, moderate, popular Republican governor of a Democratic state gets reelected, and suddenly the hard turn to the right starts vetoing everything, starts really putting down the marker, appointing more conservative people. And now after, you know, the end of his second term, what I think he ended up as the least popular governor in the history of polling in the United States. And that's what we're going to face in Maryland, especially with the Trump administration. I mean, look at the tax bill and what happened in the federal tax bill and what that's going to do to Maryland. We need a governor who is going to keep the progress that we've had in Maryland moving forward. We have so much at risk with our economy, with our healthcare system and its impact on the economy, with our tax structure. You need someone with the real experience of having made these decisions as a legislator like I have over the last 15 years, who has an understanding of why we have gotten to the point where we are, has the institutional knowledge to be informed about making their own decisions, doesn't need to be led around figuratively, literally, trying to learn about state government, and who's going to make, again, the progressive decisions that keep Maryland moving forward, committed to the policies that I think the vast majority of Marylanders,
for instance,
like
where haven't we been progressive enough under Hogan? What would you say?
Well,
I mean, you have a Democratic legislature, so.
Right. I mean, we could be doing, and we should be doing, so much more on health care. You know, as a Republican, he is loath to embrace the concept of Obamacare. But we should be out there, like Minnesota is right now, on reinsurance, the whole concept of how we can get involved in helping to bring down the cost of private insurance that's available through the exchanges, so that you actually do keep the exchanges robust. And I mean, it's very much like the Massachusetts model, what was known as Romney Care,
right,
before that got moved nationwide and became, you know, so-called Obamacare. You know, Larry Hogan can't embrace that concept because that is heresy within the Republican Party. And certainly the big-time backers of the Republican Party. So he's got to walk this fine line. He can't let the Affordable Care Act and everything that we've done in Maryland collapse, because it is so important to our economy, and like the single-payer rule, the waiver that we have from the federal government. He can't afford to let that collapse, but he can't embrace the changes because of the blowback from the Republican Party. If we're going to have this succeed, we need someone who is willing to embrace the concept of the Affordable Care Act and to keep us moving forward, who is also going to be a hard regulator, who's going to appoint people who are going to be the regulators for the healthcare industry to continue to make sure we have an insurance system, that we have the healthcare providers that are providing good services but are not exploiting the public, that is going to support, for example, our new anti-price gouging law, so that we can be firm with the pharmaceutical industries to make sure healthcare customers, whether in a hospital or whatever setting, are continuing to get value and not get fleeced. That's not going to be Larry Hogan. On education, I'm one of the 8 legislators who's on the Kerwin Commission that's looking at where are we going from a policy of for funding education, but also what sort of policy we're providing for education. You need a governor who is going to embrace the policies that we are putting forward, which means a robust and new approach to providing services for all the children of the state through the public school system. Governor Hogan is very interested in charter schools and vouchers, and they're going to be helpful to a very small segment of the population. But real change, and the change that we're going to need to keep our community prosperous for the future, and all parts of our state prosperous for the future, is going to be embracing the recommendations of the Kerwin Commission and then making sure they are funded. And
there it's going to cost some money.
It's going to cost some money, but there is no one better prepared to make those decisions than me. I was there for the Thornton process as a staff person initially.
That was the earlier process on funding for schools.
Right, yeah. But I was there as it was all put together. I was there as a legislator as it was all phased in. I've been there to understand where we succeeded, where we went wrong. I've been part of Kerwin. I've been part of this other national study group looking at lessons from abroad and how we can improve our school system. I am uniquely qualified to lead on this issue, to make sure we put in the resources, to make sure I appoint the people to the state school board, to the local school boards who are going to do the job, who are going to push to get things done. I have a good relationship. I don't look at teachers as thugs. I traditionally have a good relationship with the teachers' associations, engaging them in order to get their buy-in for the change that we're going to make. We need, and I heard this at the public hearing we had at Poly for the Kerwin Commission, we heard 60 speakers that night talk about community schools and the need to have community schools, schools where you bring the services in to the school to provide, usually the social services, to provide for the needs of the young person,
and the
family,
adults,
the community, their families. I mean, we can do this in Maryland. It makes sense that we're having remarkable success at some of the community schools in Baltimore. They should be in every neighborhood across the state because every neighborhood, every school has needs. They're different, but they have needs. That's what we have to be embracing. I mean, it's really bringing the social services into the schools, engaging families from zero forward, because we cannot assume that a child who has had a series of, whether it's traumas or any sort of deficit coming into the schools at five, can somehow have a teacher fix them.
Right.
With that trauma and those deprivations continuing, how we can assume that a teacher is going to be the magical person who comes along and fixes that child. It's amazing that it does happen for some kids, but for the vast majority who are dealing with those sorts of deficits or trauma, it's never going to work out unless you bring in the robust services.
What other countries do.
And
these community schools offer services to the adults too.
Absolutely.
Right? They can become all purpose. They're open, not open all night, but they're open longer.
And
they're used more during the day and the evening. Right.
Right. And they've got, all of our schools should be hubs for their communities, and we can make that happen. It happens around the world, and not just in places where you could say, oh, well, you know, really, you can't compare Maryland to Singapore or Finland. You know what? This is happening in the Canadian province of Ontario, and there's nothing about Metro Toronto that is different than Metro Baltimore or Metro Washington. I mean, we can do this across our state, because it's vitally important that we build a public education system that is not just the best in the country, but is the best in the world, because we have to compete with the best talent in the world.
I have one more question on policy, and then we'll have you back again in 2018, Rich, to talk some more about your candidacy. Public transportation, Hogan killed the Red Line in Baltimore.
Yep.
Would you seek to revive the Red Line project if you were elected?
Absolutely. But it also has to be part of a statewide approach to transit. I mean, we have to find a way, and a more affordable way than maglev, to bring Baltimore and Washington together, to link us up more to the south and to the north, into Virginia and into Delaware.
And not just with another highway.
And not with other highways and not with other tolls. I mean, this pie-in-the-sky craziness that the governor has put forward with, you know, the $9 billion, and I think that is a huge understatement or underestimate, for a tolling system for almost all the highways in the Washington area To add capacity is crazy. We have to find other solutions, and it's got to include transit. And the Red Line is the best approach for doing that in the Baltimore region. But you know, I would love to see us move forward with the concept of regional transportation authorities. We pay enough, and I've supported this, and I'm sure I will hear all about this during the campaign. We pay enough through our gas taxes and our vehicle taxes to support a great world-class transportation system. We've got to find a way to make sure that those taxes stay in the areas where they are paid in order to make the difference for the congestion and its impacts on the economy and the environment in the metropolitan areas. Ray LaHood, who was Secretary of Transportation under President Obama, but was a Republican congressman from Illinois before that, I heard him one time speak at the National Association of Counties, where he talked about the problem that we have a transportation system at the federal level, the state level, where gas taxes are distributed by states and the revenue is sprinkled around a state because a governor has a political necessity to do that and a desire to do that. But congestion is confined to a handful of metropolitan areas. We have two of them in our state. And that's where you pay a price economically and environmentally from the congestion. So we have to find a way to keep those revenues in the two areas and invest them in projects that are going to relieve congestion, improve the economy, improve the environment. The Red Line is part of that. I can't say every aspect of it as it was planned 2 years ago, 3 years ago is what moves forward, but it's key to moving forward. Real rapid transit bus systems are key to doing that, but possibly in a much smaller scale than we've seen before. I mean, there are a variety of things that we could be doing. I was at a presentation with several of the facilities managers for the federal facilities in the Washington area. And one of them talked about if we could work with the state to make sure that the MARC trains had adequately secured Wi-Fi networks, we could incentivize our staff to use the MARC trains by saying, as soon as you log on, your day starts. And so you've now given someone a huge incentive to use mass transit because you've now said your commute will be part of your workday.
Right.
And
interesting idea.
And that gets people, instead of in a single occupancy car and the federal government having to find a way to pay for parking on these limited campuses like in Bethesda, now you're out of your car. You have a good reason to get out of your car. We should be working with large employment centers, whether it's like NIH or like the downtown Salisbury community, to figure out how we do different type of busing, buses that use modern technology, an Uber style, not fixed routes, but routes that are constantly changing to meet the needs of the people who are using the system. The technology is out there to do it. We can partner that with what the state does well. The state can purchase things in volume cheaply, and we can employ people with benefits and living wages. You marry that to technology, and now suddenly you have a robust system that can constantly change to meet the needs of the people who are using it. We could be leading the country in this sort of effort, but we're not, because we're playing small ball under Governor Hogan. You know, we're just playing for what sounds good in a poll, what looks good in a poll, what looks good at a press conference and a press release. But other than that, it's just designed, as I said at the very beginning, to get us through the next election as opposed to get us through the next generation. We need the big thinking that we once had in Maryland, because we've been where big ideas have come from for the whole country. Baltimore is where the first gas lamps turned on in North America. Baltimore is where the first telegraph was. Baltimore was where the first railroad was. Baltimore has been, innovation in Baltimore and in Maryland has been key to moving the country forward, the world forward. We need to get back to that place.
Rich, thank you very much. We'll see you again next year.
Thank you, Dan.
Maryland State Senator Richard Medalino is a Democrat seeking his party's nomination for governor in the June 2018 primary. Maddaleno recently became the first of the eight contenders for the gubernatorial nomination to choose public financing for his primary campaign. He said that decision to accept public funding gives him the opportunity to raise as much as $2.8 million, with an estimated $1.4 million of it in public funds. You can catch previous interviews with candidates for governor in the Roughly Speaking archives. Coming up this week and next, interviews with two more Democrats, Maya Rocky Moore Cummings and Krish Vignaraja. Today's close music is courtesy of Helicon and Charm City Junction. Their 32nd annual Winter Solstice concert takes place this Saturday at Krauschauer Auditorium at Goucher College in Towson with two shows, one at 3:30 and one at 7:30 p.m. Ticket information for this great holiday season tradition can be found in the notes of this podcast. That's our show for now. I hope you enjoyed it. Comments welcome. Please review the show on iTunes if you get a chance. The producers of Roughly Speaking are Steve Early and Quinn Kelly. This is Dan Rodericks here at The Sun. Thanks for listening to Roughly Speaking, and we'll see you again soon.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy stocks a wide selection of books covering Baltimore and the Chesapeake Bay region, many by local authors. Located at 6080 Falls Road, more information can be found at theivybookshop.com or by calling 410-377-2966. Thank you.